It's Wednesday, November 19th, 2008, and you're listening to episode 124 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 44 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Tex.
And my name is Ed.
And just to explain who the intruder is, This is Ed Healy from Atomic Array. And you also do some other stuff in the RPG industry. If you want to give everyone the nickel tour of stuff they don't care about and
should care about it.
Why?
Atomic Array, man.
Maybe they don't care about all the other stuff. So
okay, I'm the ad sales guy for Kobold Quarterly, which is Wolfgang Bauer's print magazine. Came out after the death of Dragon. I also sell advertising on some of the blogs out there. So if you're at dungeonmastering.com or Gnome Stew and you see ads, that's my fault. I apologize.
So Ed, I don't know if you're qualified to answer this because you're not Wolfgang, but being involved in it, you mentioned that Kobold Quarterly was put out pseudo in response to the passing of Dungeon and Dragon, but Pathfinder was also put out at, kind of on the heels of Dungeon and Dragon. So the same company really picked up an extremely similar idea under a different title, and I'm curious how that figured into the decision to put out something like Kobold Quarterly.
Well, Kobold Quarterly was kind of a response to the Death of Dragon magazine, but it was kind of a fluke. Wolf wanted to have a magazine that people could hold in their hands, and Dragon wasn't going to fill that need anymore. So he figured, I'll print out a couple hundred copies. We'll see if people like it. And now it's kind of gotten out of control. Now we have thousands of copies out there, and it's a little bit more than a fanzine now.
Now, I do have a technical question about advertising. We were talking about this at the game day we went to today, where the difference between the lead time with print media and internet media. And so somebody was asking you, like, if they wanted to get something into the next magazine, that you would need 4 to 6 weeks of lead time for that, where obviously with the internet, you can have a much shorter lead time. So what type of lead times would you need for different things on different websites and or print media?
Well, you know, it's funny because sometimes even in digital media, you need lead times. And it really comes down to how much money are you going to spend and are you going to make it worth the person's while? I'll give you an example. I sell advertising on Second Life TV, which is the TV network in Second Life. And I could give somebody an ad next week, but is it really worth my time to jerry-rig the entire production schedule? No. So I'll tell them, you can come back in December.
All right. As someone who's only peripherally aware of Second Life, the hell do you show on Second Life TV, like baby fervert sex or?
Oh, no, actually, there's SLCN has 6 channels and 18 shows now, and it ranges from an interview show with an author to giant snail races, which is exactly what it sounds like, giant virtual snails racing through it.
So they actually have something kind of wholesome and worth consuming in Second Life.
Yeah, I know. Shocker, huh?
This is all news to me. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I've never actually personally played Second Life, but what I have seen from the democratization of creativity on the internet is that 99% of the stuff that you're going to see is standard YouTube rubbish, but you know, every once in a while you find a real diamond in the rough where somebody has come up with something so original and creative that you'd never even have thought of it yourself or would even find it anywhere else.
You know, speaking of rough, I got to bust the balls of my fellow hosts who aren't here right now. A while back, we got an email from a woman who wanted to come on the show, and she is a LARPing furry pastor. And when I heard this, I'm like, we have got to get this woman on the show. This is a gold mine. This everything she says is going to be perfect.
Too bad you can't do your first video episode that way.
Well, we've already done our first video episode and probably should do a second because the first one kind of sucked. But
well, I think a LARPing furry pastor might be a great second video episode.
I believe so.
But absolutely nobody on the cast supported this. And so it never occurred. It
was what?
Yes, it was just me. I was out there alone in the dark. So.
Where is she? We can just bring her over tomorrow and we'll record one here before you go to the airport.
Yeah. You know what? If you're used to listen to the show, send an email to dan@feartheboot.com. I'm interested in hearing what you have to say. Ignore the closed-minded plebeians that I work with. So anyway, we were at this game day today over at, if you're in the Seattle area, something worth checking out, you can go to emeraldcitygamefest.org. And this is put on by a group up here locally that actually has little gaming meetups every Thursday. And then they put on these game days throughout the year and had a ton of fun. It was a really great bunch of people. And one of the things I got to thinking about while I was there, oh, and by the way, if you don't remember that URL, put it in the show notes. But one of the things I got to thinking about while I was there is the difference between a large convention say Gen Con, Origins, Dragon Con, even our local one like Archon, which has several thousand people, versus these smaller game days like the Emerald City Game Fest we just went to, and also even Fear the Con. I mean, Fear the Con's a little different because we have the strange distinction of being one of the few small game days that's national. As opposed, you know, most game days, you're going to have probably 50 to 200 people from your area gaming clubs and gaming shops coming in, just hanging out and gaming, whereas ours was a national diaspora of people. But still, nonetheless, it had all the other characteristics of a game day. And I'm actually coming to find that I prefer the game days to the cons, which is strange coming from someone who's not a big fan of gaming with groups of strangers.
Well, to be fair, though, I think it's two completely different purposes why we're there. I mean, when we're at a convention, we're typically working in some way, shape, or form. We have a schedule to keep. We have panels to speak at or panels to attend, or we have to be at booths for demos, or we're supposed to be interviewing people. Where at this game fest we were at today, we were literally there just to hang out, and we were approached out of the blue by someone who was running a GURPS game and had three open seats and asked if we wanted to join. And we didn't have to be on his schedule or have to have tickets or anything like that. So it was just one of those, sure, why not moments.
Yeah, and that's definitely part of it. There's certainly an informality in these game days you don't see in the cons. But I also think the focus and intimacy of them adds to that. Because if you go to a large con, you're talking somewhere between 3,000, I'm going to go up to Gen Con, like 40,000 people that are coming together from all over the nation. Most of these people do not know each other. I mean, you might have some friends you run into every year at Gen Con or people you know from forums or whatever, but you don't know the vast majority of the people there. The schedules are packed with a wide variety of things to do that are spread out by necessity over a large geographic area.
Well, and you're almost paralyzed by the options.
The choices, you're going to miss out on something.
At Gen Con, even if you decided, okay, I'm going to go sit in on three random games. I mean, I, to be honest, would be almost paralyzed by the volume of choices I would have to make, spread out across even multiple buildings across several city blocks, where with this I was literally able to survey the room. And to be honest, if we hadn't gotten picked up by that GURPS group, I might have jumped into a Ticket to Ride or Catan game.
Yeah, the Catan game right across the table.
Yeah.
We were looking at that.
Or if they were ever going to do a joint convention with the Seattle Masochistic Society, I could have done Starfleet Battles.
I just like that game days are fire and forget. You know that you're there. Once you leave, it's over. It's not like, I got to go back to my hotel room. I got to figure out where I'm going to go.
That's
eat.
Very true as well.
I don't have to fly. Well, you did, but I don't have to fly here, there, and everywhere. It's just, you know what? I know at the end of the day, I'm going to go home to my house, and that's it.
You know, in addition to that, I also like the fact that because they are generally populated by local people, you can build upon relationships that actually last. You can really get to know people in your local gaming scene, for better or for worse. But nonetheless, as time goes on, it's pretty much inevitable that your gaming group is going to change. People are going to leave. Everybody might leave. You might leave. Who knows what will happen. And so it's kind of a great place to start meeting some new people and seeing who's there that you might want to invite to join your gaming group, or whose gaming group you might want to sit in on, or even just people that you can tag just for, hey, you know, we're going to carpool up to this big national convention together, or we just need some more people to make a tournament work. And these are people that you can really get to know. Whereas at a con, I mean, I've met some wonderful people, and some of these people I've even stayed in contact with. But I don't know if really anyone that I could just grab for a local game. These are not people that I see or even could see face-to-face multiple times throughout the year.
Right. And speaking of which, too, I did want to give a shout-out or a thanks to everybody who took the time and effort to set up and run or GM a game today. That's actually a lot of work sometimes to drag all your stuff to a location and set it up and hope a bunch of strangers want to have a good time with you. And I'm sure it's a lot of work that the players often don't realize or don't appreciate.
They had a dozen tables running games at all times, and most of those were scheduled out ahead of time. So it was kind of cool because, I mean, that took at least two dozen people ahead of time planned out events for just a small local gaming
day,
you know?
So you know what? If you are not involved in some kind of a local gaming circuit, believe me, I will be the last person in the world to give a hearty endorsement to hanging out and gaming with random strangers. But it is still something you ought to at least consider checking out and getting more involved in. And, I mean, there are tons of these clubs in every major city, and even some in some not so major cities. So if that's an option for you, it's certainly worth checking out. You know, actually, two quick shout outs I have. I'll start with the one that's related to that convention. While I was there, Heath White, who's Mr. White on our forums, he was going to catch up with me, and I recognized he was actually wearing a Fear the Boot t-shirt. And
I actually had to do a double take because you and I were there wearing Fear the Boot t-shirts, and I glanced up and saw a third one. I'm like, really? I wasn't aware that there were more than...
I was pissed that I missed them because on your boards, I was supposed to go to Worldwide Wing Night, and I couldn't go, the one that he did.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, I'll see you hopefully at the Game Fest.
You're not the only Seattle resident that skipped his Worldwide Wing Night.
Yes, I also need to owe an apology there. Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess, with my work, the September, October, November time frame is incredibly busy for me at work.
Well, anyway,
starting to sound like Charlie Brown's teacher the longer he goes on. So anyway, the shout out I want to give to him was he's, you know, stopped by to talk to me. And at the time, I was trying to find a way to politely lose the Skirps game because we represented 50% of the table, which means we were going to kill the game. But we need to get out of there so we could do this recording and take care of some other stuff. And I just, my mind was on 100 different things. And so when Heath came over, I was completely spaced out and pretty much incapable of carrying on any kind of a conversation with him. So I feel kind of bad about that, but Heath will definitely catch up with you on the next one.
Did he come to the table, or did you meet him on the way out?
Well, no, he kind of came walking by the table, and I saw the shirt and then got up and walked over to talk to him.
Okay, right.
But that was, I think by that point, you had actually already gone out the door.
Yeah, so mentally or physically, I was already.
One of the two, maybe both. But the other person I wanted to give a shout out to was Sean. While I was at Worldwide Wing Night in St. Louis, several of your friends stopped by and wanted us to tell you that we're praying for you. So, Sean, hold yourself together.
Oh, for the third shot, do you remember who it was?
Suitably cryptic, right?
Yes,
so
I'm sure.
Absolutely no idea.
I have no idea what he's talking about.
There's a backstory there that I don't know I should tell on the air. So, yes,
to be honest, I don't know if I really care.
It's significant to half a dozen people, and I realize that. So,
but a third kind of shout out I wanted to give is somebody actually approached us at the convention because we were, or the games day, and because we were wearing our t-shirts, said, "Oh, wow, you guys are from Fear the Boot. That's awesome. It's great to meet you." And he's reading my shirt, and he's like, "Oh, you have a podcast?"
And he was serious. It's like, what is it you know us for? He had no idea our site had a podcast on it.
It's either our incredibly lively forums,
right,
or perhaps the Chainmail Bikini comic.
Well, so I could believe either, but even with Chainmail Bikini, I mean, it was, you had to go to feartheboot.com. They mentioned the podcast on there. There was a banner for the podcast above the comic. So it's like, I have no idea how you would know our website and not even be aware. I know there are people that visit our forum or visit our site for the comic or the forum or even now with the blog who do not listen to the podcast, and they have their reasons why, and I understand that.
Because it sucks.
Yeah. It's not an atomic array, but we try.
Yeah. Well, it's either that or me whining about my work-life balance.
Yeah, exactly. Boo-hoo. But nonetheless, you know, it just baffles me that someone could go to the site and not even know we have a podcast. But you know what? God bless you, and more power to you if you're finding our site and completely unaware of anything on there. So anyway,
it's so pretty.
Ed, I want to pick your brain about some stuff while we got you on here. So one of the things we've talked about on this show, and we've tried to do with the interview series, which I probably let go cold for too long, but one of the things that we've tried to do on this show is demystify the parts of gaming that people aren't that familiar with. Because certainly, as you go out and consume the material, you're aware of the systems and settings that are out there. You may even over time start to notice the artists and the authors and go and talk to them or whatever. You get some sense of that side of the role-playing games. But most role-players do not know very much about the business side of role-playing games. The production, the printing, how much you can expect to sell, how much you can expect to make, how you get people to pick up your game. And so I want to talk with you about that because this is an area that you have some expertise in. So let's say...
Very little, but I'll give you what I got.
You make your living off of it. If you have very little, I would admit that on the air. This is why you're not a surgeon. So let's say for a minute that I'm a guy sitting at home, and I've got my own game that I'm messing around with, which probably describes the vast majority of role players at some point in their role playing life.
Everyone wants to do
their own thing. Sake of this conversation, let's say your game is actually complete and ready for publication.
Because we're not talking about the design of a role playing game. We birthed that baby once.
It's fully laid out. It's not on paper yet necessarily, but it's fully laid out, ready to either be printed or turned into an RPG Now product.
Yeah, it was ready to go to it's ready to go to PDF or it's ready to go to print.
Right.
We're basically done. We're not going to deal with the design side of it because we birthed that barbed wire baby and I'm done with that. But let's start talking about the rest of it. So I've got my RPG in hand. You were doing a panel at Gen Con with Ryan Dancy and Mike Stackpole. I think Mike Stackpole wasn't able to attend,
right?
And so Ryan gave you the question, if you could tell a person in that situation just one thing, what would it be? And what was your answer to that question?
Demo your game.
Why?
Well, you know what? It's a game. What do you want? You want people to play it. Right? You don't want people to pick it up and admire the great art, although that is useful, but you want people to play it. And the other reason is because those people are going to tell their friends about how awesome your game is, hopefully, if it's a good game. A great example would be Cthulhu Tech. It's a game that I was at one of the local stores they were playing. I sat down, did a pickup game with them, thought it was really cool. I tell people that I like the game because, you know, if you're looking for a post-apocalyptic Cthulian type game, I say, hey, pick up Cthulhu Tech. It's happened. Actually, Catalyst just came out with a new version of it, so you got a good company behind it, and it's a good game, so I suggest people buy it.
Let's talk about reviews for a sec. Tex, you want to take this one? Because we were talking earlier, we were actually talking about video games, but we were talking
about games in general. Like,
well, right.
The question was, do you care?
Well, the question, I think, is broad enough. It could apply to both video games and tabletop games.
Do you care about reviews? Well, actually, I think we're talking about movies. We're talking about the James Bond.
Yeah, we're talking about movies, games, Barbie dolls. It doesn't matter. Furries. Do you care about some guy you don't know who writes up a review about something?
Right. And what Ed just brought up, I think, ties into that nicely, that we've learned, like, with video games.
Yeah, we being Microsoft.
Microsoft.
Not the people at this table. So.
Right. But it, like I said, the concept applies very broadly, that the single most powerful force in marketing is a positive or negative reference from somebody that you personally know and trust. And if your family member or your roommate or your gaming buddy gives you a raging endorsement or a terrible recommendation of a certain product, that will influence your likelihood to purchase it more than print advertising, more than online advertising, more than
absolutely
than the side of a bus or a billboard. And so one of the things that we, Microsoft, have wrestled with, but again, I guess it applies more broadly because it also applies to like Amazon.com. So one of the things that we were trying to get is the ability for you to see the recommendations or the experiences of your friends, because we have a much better chance of getting you to purchase a game if you know that your friends are playing it versus some anonymous reviewer.
You know, I tell you, you guys have an advantage there, which is I cannot or do not log on to RPG Live to play a role-playing game, as opposed to Xbox Live, or if I want to play an online game via Xbox, I have to go on Xbox Live to do it. And so I may not see a broad network of friends and how they've rated things. You know, you don't have kind of that big social network going on there. Not saying word of mouth doesn't get around. There is no social network of RPGers, because there is. But I'm just saying it's somewhat of a different beast. But
you don't have that centralized.
Right.
It's not as central.
It's
but
not centralized and formalized. I'm not saying it isn't there. But
let's be honest. You have different ways to interact with people who are gamers. And when we're talking about gaming, you have internet, and that's great, but that's not every gamer. And that's why, as much as I love how we have the PDF industry and how well RPG Now is doing, the fact of the matter is that if you want to make more of a splash, get more of your copies of your games in somebody's hands, you got to print it. People want to hold onto a game. They want to walk into their local gaming store, pick up a copy of the game, thumb through it, and maybe sit down at the table and play it with somebody. It's more of a physical relationship that we have with this medium that we have. And, you know, computer games are great, and we have a lot of people that play them, but this particular medium that we're in, ask the guys from Rogue Games. I mean, they did a great thing where they, you know, had a community built up while they were designing it, and they've sold some games over the internet, but most of their games that they've sold have been physical copies through distribution. So as much as the PDF is great, it's not going to kill.
So even if somebody, for example, had made a game that they wanted to sell and they were at a convention demoing it, you would still recommend that they have something in print form, even if it's just in three-ring binders?
Oh, absolutely.
Here's the thing. I can put up a banner ad and reach thousands of people all over the nation all at once with relatively minimal work. But if I want to really demo in a way to actually effectively get the word out and keep the word moving, because one becomes two, becomes three, becomes four is nice, but it's probably better that I make 10 become 20, become 30, become 40. So I got to keep demoing. One demo is not enough.
Correct.
And that's a lot of work and a lot of time.
I never said it was easy, but I mean, talk to Peter Atkinson about Magic the Gathering. It's not like the guy came up with an idea, threw some art on a card, and then 2 weeks later was making millions of dollars. They spent a lot of time and a lot of effort going from store to store, demoing that game, and it didn't blow up right away. It took time. And unfortunately, for people may not realize that there is a lot more work, especially in this industry, in any industry, of just person-to-person, direct contact, getting people. You got to find those proselytes out there. You got to find your disciples who are going to spread the word.
People who love your product even more than you do.
Absolutely. Exactly. That's what you need. You need the true believers.
Yes.
You need those fanboys. You need those people that are going to be salivating for the next release of your product. You need those people that are going to go shout the virtues of it from the rooftops and get all their buddies to play it and then get into internet fights with people that disagree with them because...
Troll wars.
Well, I don't know it's necessarily virtuous but I think nonetheless it's that word of mouth and that buzz and that activity.
And you can facilitate the word of mouth. I mean, look at the way Paizo, if you like their products, you go to their site and there's a vibrant community of, 10 to 20,000 people that talk about their stuff on a regular basis. They have a community there that people are plugged into. And they leverage that community to offer gaming products that those people like. You guys have Fear the Boot forums, and I'm sure... Well, actually, I know because I'm there on a regular basis. You know, somebody has something they want to talk about, and if it is related to their podcast or their new game product that they just, you know, did some work on, you know, you have shameless plugs, right? And
right.
Some people go there, and they'll actually interact with the person. But not just that. I mean, I'll be on there, and I'll be talking about, hey, I'm not really into pulp gaming, film noir or whatever, but I want to try it out. Anybody have a suggestion? I'm going to do it on your forum or I'm going to do it on another forum. And those people who have made that connection with the game are going to speak up. They may have never said a word. They may have been those people who are never coming out of the closet, so to speak. You know, but there's going to be a booter somewhere that likes a film noir game and can point me at it and say, well, you know, might want to check out this one. And that's what you're after. It's not going to be all the time in your face, but those people are out there who love your stuff. And in engaging them in a meaningful fashion is much more valuable than, let's say, throwing up, you know, 10,000 banner ads on sites that may be blocked by an ad blocker anyway.
Well, with an advertising thing, I mean, one of the things that we're struggling with a little bit with the democratization of so many industries, music and film and video gaming and tabletop gaming with the internet, is that there is a lot of material, a great deal of options for a potential consumer. But also, not to be cruel, but the vast majority of them aren't of outstanding quality.
Well, it's like the same thing we say about podcasting. It's this whole Web 2.0 thing in general. The great thing about new media is that anyone can do it. The worst thing about new media is that anyone can do it.
Yeah, well, that's much more succinct than my faltering attempt to not be too harsh. But if you were approached as an advertiser with a game or a product that you didn't think had a very good chance of succeeding, would you recommend that the person go ahead and advertise now, or would you actually maybe recommend that they go back to the drawing board, or is that not even your place to say?
I actually don't review all the games that somebody advertises, you know, in the magazine or online or wherever. I do, however, give advice for how to utilize more effectively the advertisements that they're using. Whether the ad is ineffective, you know, needs to have a communication. There has to be something there that draws the attention. But the honest God truth is, regardless of whether it's an advertisement for a game or, hey guys, I want to have a pickup game on this play by post, you need to give somebody something that draws their attention. And then after they pay attention, follow that up. Collect that attention that you've earned and monopolize on it.
You know, we spoke about that walking over to the Games Fest today after lunch, that there are good ads and there are bad ads.
Right.
So I guess, for example, if I wanted to put a banner ad on the internet, what's some advice you could tell me about? These are some of the things that make a good banner ad versus the things that make a bad banner ad.
Well, you know, let's make the question even broader than that. Applying the good old Pareto principle, I would wager that probably the majority of the problems you have are on a relatively short list of issues.
Right.
Just because that's the case with anything. That if there's something wrong with my ad campaign, be it a banner ad, anything, there's three or five things that everybody screws up again and again and again. What are those things?
Well, the first one, absolutely the first one, is regardless of what your ad is, once somebody responds to it, if you're clicking on an ad or you're going to a website, they've given you permission to market to them at that point. They've asked you to tell them more about your product, and your execution needs to be thought out, and it needs to be, I don't want to say perfect, but it needs to be better than a lot of the things that you see out there. If I click on a banner advertisement, right, and I go to your site and I don't see something that speaks to me, if your ad was about, you know, Deadlands, the role-playing game, and I go to the Deadlands site and I don't see something that engages me and draws me further into the Deadlands mythos, I have wasted that opportunity to monopolize on somebody's interest in,
well, speaking
in,
from,
in a post-apocalyptic cowboy setting, you know, right. So.
Well, speaking from personal experience, I know the two that infuriate me the most are I click on a banner ad because, as you said, that I have now initiated contact. I've said, I'm responding to your ad. I want more information. And I either go into a site that's basically a box canyon where I'm just watching a basically what I would say is an analog of a television commercial where I'm watching a one-way stream of information just being sent to me.
Yes.
Which would be appropriate for television or radio, but not for the internet.
Or a wasteland where you don't know what the hell you're looking at.
Right, or where they make me start working for it, where I have to start mining information.
A good example would everyone who's been on the internet more than 5 minutes now and has been on a blog might see those little social me or link this type
stumble upon,
dig, whatever it is.
Delicious,
right. And if you click on let's say you're using Stumble Upon and you show up at a site and it doesn't draw your attention, your first response is to click away. I mean, we are very jaded to the internet. I mean, it's, yes, our generation.
To someone who's a web developer by trade, that happens very quickly. The amount of time that someone will spend on a site, if you do not grab their attention, is some very, very small number of seconds.
It's like 3 seconds.
Yeah.
Four seconds.
Yeah. Then I think that's shooting actually a little higher than most statistics I've heard. So,
right. Because,
it's,
you know,
very fast.
It's enough time for them to scan to see, is there something in larger print that tells me,
right,
to grab my attention and read. And there's all sorts of little research and stuff, advertising web stuff.
Right.
You know, little things like, you know, your headline needs to be around 10, 11 words. It can't be more because nobody can adjust, pull that into their brain real quickly. And
right,
it needs to be engaging. And yes, art, you know, speaks 1,000 words very quickly. So if you have crappy art, you're going to kill, you know, whatever. All those things are great. But the truth of the matter is that there are reasons why gamers look at game websites. They're either looking for the product that you promised in the advertisement, or maybe a free review, a free preview, so that they can get a taste, or they're looking for a community around that, a product that they've already picked up in the store. And if all you're giving them is a press release, or all you're giving them is the same garbage on the back of the, you know, the pop, the point of purchase stuff, and there's nothing else there, then why do you have a website? You need, you know, why do you have this vehicle if you're not giving them anything else? There's no reason for them to go there. Then why advertise it?
Now, you actually hit on something that's a little near and dear to my heart, where if you do give away a free sample, how much should you give away? How little should you give away in order to entice somebody to convert? The reason it's near and dear to my heart, of course, is because every Xbox Live Arcade game has a free demo.
Free demo, right.
And
I just worked on one for an Xbox game.
Right, and one of the things that we're very concerned about is, okay, once we give every person the opportunity to download a free demo, what's the conversion rate? What's the likelihood that they're going to translate that demo into a purchase?
Well, see, that's even harder with the role-playing games. The video game, it's easy. I give you the first level, or the first 2 hours of play,
right,
or certain features. With an RPG, what do I do? After you've played the game for one sitting, the PDF explodes.
There's fast play rules. There's stuff like
right,
that are the equivalent of an Xbox demo. But maybe we're going to be just changing topics and getting into how do you design a game get somebody into the field quicker, you know, than what we have now, where it's like 14 million tables with all this stuff you got
to
learn.
Well, I think it's still relevant to the advertising premise of this whole conversation, in that a demo or a sample, I mean, the purpose of it is to entice that customer to convert to a paying customer.
Right.
So I think it's still relevant.
I mean, honestly, I mean, let's back up a little bit, because advertising is just a tactic. What you want to do is not advertise. What you want to do is market. Marketing is communication with your customers, whether it's through customer service, through advertising, through whatever vehicle you use. Marketing is communicating the virtues of your business and your product to your customers. Sales is communication designed to end up with an action, you know, buy this car,
right,
buy this. And advertising is somewhere in the middle, where you're informing, hoping that they will go to make that purchasing decision.
Well, and I assume the dilemma with a sample would be, if you give them too much, they have no reason to buy the product because the sample is already adequate. And if you give them too little, then you haven't necessarily compelled them to buy the product.
That's, you know, each industry, each publisher, each manufacturer of a certain type of product, they have to make that decision, because it works differently for each person. You go to Costco and there's all those people at the end of every single row giving you a free taste of the hot dogs, or, you know, the Grey Poupon or whatever it is. That's great, because you have to buy more to get more, right? But with an Xbox game, or with a PDF for a role-playing game, yes, you can't just make it blow up.
Right. You could, in theory, use the sample over and over for free forever if you chose to. And, you know, that's not necessarily a bad or a wrong thing. But obviously, the purpose or the goal of a publisher, be it of a video game or role-playing game, is to generate revenue by enticing you to make a purchase.
And I think it'd be more effective if you were to engage your customers in a meaningful conversation relationship, where on a regular basis you were engaging them on a human level. Advertising, whatever marketing vehicle that you use, shouldn't just be used to say buy now. It should be to bring the, and this is my opinion, should bring, be used to bring them into a relationship with you as a company, so that you can get to know your customers, get to know what their likes and dislikes are. Not every company and not every publishing product is going to be for everybody, but you will be able to find those people who are most likely to appreciate what you have to offer, and be able to respond to what they like and what they don't like in a more effective manner if you are engaged with them. Unfortunately, that takes a lot more time and energy on a human level than what most people are interested in putting up with.
Well,
but it's way more effective.
True, but I was just thinking, for example, about what you're talking about with a role-playing game sample, where you would maybe give them the quick play rules, where you take a person like Chad, for example, who's not really very interested in crunchy, rules-heavy systems. He would probably be perfectly happy to use the quick play rules for a sustained period of time, so long as you gave him adequate information about the genre or the universe. And so I was thinking, even with a role-playing game, if I was to give a sample, would there be advantage to giving a subset of the rules, but also a subset of the universe, or a subset of character classes, or...
But still hint at enough of the rest of the rules, right, and setting, yeah, to give them the sense they're missing something. Because I think certainly if the product...
We just withhold the healers.
Well,
you know,
if it's too complete...
Every company does it differently.
Yeah.
Rogue Games, their opinion is that we're going to make our game over four or five, maybe six products, and that's it. We're done. We're not interested in constant rules expansions, constant setting expansions over a long period of time. We're going to make this game, and pretty much a year or two from now, it's over. It's complete. Whereas other companies, their model is, we make a huge amount of really interesting stuff that you're constantly going to have to come back to us for. That's their model. Cheap ass games, theirs was, here's, you know, for $3 you get something that you can play over and over and over and over again. They don't need to do demos because their price point's so low. So every company, based on their target audience and what the likes and dislikes of their demographic is, and what their product that they're offering, is going to be different. The question becomes, what's your company and your product's character like? Because that's what you need to use. You need to use as a basis for your marketing or for your interaction with your customers.
Now, that actually gave me another interesting thought. Do you ever discuss with people where they set their price points and make recommendations about price points?
I don't.
When you put out a sample or a demo that's designed to entice a user to purchase, there is a group of people who basically will never, ever pay money. So even if you set your price point at 4 cents, there's a group of people that will never, ever pay any amount of money above zero. And then there is a group of people who will pay. And the thing is, if they feel that your game is worth it and they're willing to pay, they would pay $5, but they might also pay
$50,
$6, $7, $8, or $9, or $10. And so a lot of times what we found is that if you price a game at $10, you'll sell, you know, X number of copies. And if you price it at $5, you'll sell more, but not twice as much more. And so I didn't know if there was an analog to that in the gaming industry, where basically if you cut the price in half, you don't necessarily double the amount of purchases.
I'm definitely not a professional price point determiner. However, if you're talking strictly PDF, for instance, I would go and look at some of the publishers that have been around for 10 years. Adamant, Lewis Porter, and some of the others that have been around for a very long time, and see how they price their stuff. And that would probably give you a good indication of, based on number of pages and word count and art and whatever, what you would probably want to price point at. Because they've done the research through trial and error already. They know what the market will hold. In print, it's fairly standard. I mean, you look at a book that's, let's say, 240 or 256 pages, and you're probably paying around $30 for it. And there's a reason for it, depending on, you know, the quality of it. I would say if you're really interested in that kind of information, I would talk to Aldo at Impressions, because he gives that advice to publishers on a regular basis. And he has given me the talk down on it, but I don't have it memorized.
Yeah, it was going to be one of my questions for you, because I know we're hitting at the high level, something that could probably have its own podcast.
Yeah.
And we can't possibly get into all the ins and outs of this. Maybe we'll come back to this in a later show and get you back on again. But in the interim, if this is something that I'm interested in, where would you recommend I go for some education on this, just so I don't make the five most common mistakes in this particular line of work?
If you're looking to publish a game, there's actually three people that have done a really good job at it and are astonishingly open about their thoughts on the subject. Ryan Dancy from CCP is always writing about one aspect or another, or I don't know how much he's done recently, but in the past he has. You've got Peter Atkinson from Wizards of the Coast that, you know, obviously gave us Magic the Gathering, so he's done some success there and knows his way around. And then John Zinzer from AEG. Those three guys have probably got the most serious knowledge about publishing. But, you know, honestly, you can see a lot of the mid-tier, what I would call mid-tier publishers that also have it. The Paizo guys, you can see their success through customer service and whatnot, and they're very open on their forums about their views on things. Fire them emails. A lot of the people in this industry are very open and very willing to discuss things. Shoot them an email and ask them, or get them on Facebook, or get them on somewhere and just ask them a question. And they may not get back to you tomorrow, but chances are, if you're not a weirdo, they will get back to you and they will give you something useful. As far as, like, if you're looking for marketing, I would listen to another podcast, actually, Marketing Over Coffee, which is, they're not gamers, they're just, it's a weekly podcast, it's like 20 something minutes long, and it's all about marketing, and it's probably the most useful marketing podcast out there. So I would definitely listen to that show on a regular basis if you want marketing tips in general. For the gaming industry, there is no, hey, this is how you publish a game. Right. However, there are people that
have selling your dungeon crawl for dummies.
Yeah, you know, well,
there's a great opportunity if someone's looking to write a book.
Ken Height did something a few years ago. Skarka did something a few years ago. There's been a couple of attempts at it, but most of those are years old now. So things change a little bit, but the principles are the same. You could look up any number of those. I think there's a Game Marketing 101 or Game Publishing 101. You could look that up on RPG Now and grab it for, like, I don't know, $10 or whatever it is. But yeah, somebody who wants to write a book, probably be a good book to write. What about you, Dan? Want to write a book?
Ed, I think we're going to go ahead and wrap this up here. So do you want to give us kind of a punchline, a moral? If you walk away from this with nothing else, walk away with this.
Well, yeah, advertising is a great tool. It's a good tactic to use, and used properly, it'll be effective. But it's really about marketing. It's really about communicating with your customers effectively. And if you're not willing to communicate with your customers, if you just want to broadcast to them, then no amount of tactics are going to help you. It's really about your desire to communicate and connect with the people who you want their money. I mean, really, honestly, it's a gamer, a company who's publishing a game. They look at a gamer and they need to see more than just somebody with a wallet.
You know, is there some value to turning the equation around to, it struck me, at least in my, just within my own head, that when I go to buy a game, I have certain criteria that I use to pick the game out. And some of them are very easy to define. Some of them are entirely esoteric. But when I sit down to create a game, suddenly it's like I have no idea what makes people buy RPGs anymore. Do you kind of follow what I'm saying? Is there some advantage there in kind of reminding yourself that you are on the other side of the equation? That, and you could apply this to anything. We all know really, really bad ad campaigns that have been done online, on TV, whatever, that would never convince anyone to buy anything. And I kind of have to wonder, it's like, you know, the people that make these ads ever think, gee, what is it that motivates me to buy? And is this the kind of company that I'd want to do business with, or the kind of ad that would move me to get off my couch and take out my credit card?
Well, I think even to refine the question, obviously, once you have a product out and it's been consumed by a number of people, the consumer is usually willing to come back and talk to you and give feedback. But how do you learn your customer, or know about your customer, or know what would work before you've gone to market?
Market testing. That's why game days are rocking, because you can go and you can see and test with a small microcosm of what's out there.
Yeah.
Or send it to, you know, send it to some people and just have, you know,
personally,
give me your opinion of this.
With my sci-fi setting, I ran it Fear the Con last year. I got a really good insight into how people would react to the setting. And in this case, the feedback was, you know, fortunately all very positive. But even if it hadn't been, you know, still, I got a chance to see how it spins. So that's certainly a great idea. You know, like we've been saying, take that game out there and try it out at a con with some strangers who
aren't Dan.
Yeah, aren't me.
Well, you know, you were saying you work on websites, right?
Right.
So you do the same thing. If you have the time and you've got the dedication, you'll sit somebody who's never seen your site down and say, interact with my site, and you watch where they're clicking and where how they're interacting with the material on your website, because you want to be the most effective means of getting your information to them. It's the same thing with your games. If you're sitting down, let's say you wrote an adventure and you're running it at a convention, and they're just not getting the points that you thought were blatantly obvious, because rule number one about game design or adventure design is that the players are never going to do what you think they're going to do. They're always going to do something totally different, and it may not be obvious to them that MacGuffin in the room is what they're supposed to be going after. You're not going to know that unless you play test with somebody.
Right. Actually, too, speaking of samples and things that can be downloaded where you can engage with the customer early on, this just wouldn't be Dan and Tex, and this just wouldn't be Fear the Boot if I didn't mention one very wonderful example of a game that does have a free downloadable sample that gives you a pretty complete quick play experience, which would be Classic Battletech.
I thought you were going to say Savage Worlds.
No,
I'm sorry. It just wouldn't be Dan Tex and Fear the Boot if we didn't give a plug for Battletech.
No, I do like Savage Worlds, but it does not have the same place in my heart that Battletech does. So.
But there actually is
25th anniversary coming up.
But there actually is a downloadable sample of Battletech that I got to see at Gen Con 2 years ago.
Yeah, what about 2 years ago?
And that I actually, as someone who dearly loves the game, I thought was a pretty good little sample.
So
cool.
I wonder if that's even still around, but who knows?
Yeah.
So anyway, thank you guys for tuning in, and also be sure to check out what Ed Healy does over at Atomic Array. I'll be sure to link his show off the show notes if you want to go see what he's got to do, or go onto his website and write him your harassing advertising questions directly. I'm sure he'd love to get them.
Or write them to Dan, because he likes talking about stuff.
Yeah. So thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2008, fully owned by its hosts. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to FearTheBoot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at FearTheBoot.com.